A city is stronger together. So let's hear from the business and community leaders that keep Milwaukee on the upswing. Presented by Horicon Bank, the natural choice for all your banking needs. Now here's the host that's always on the upswing, WTMJ's Jeff Sherman.
Now, to business, gentlemen.
Welcome to the Upswing. I'm Jeff Sherman. We are proudly presented by the good community-minded people at Horicon Bank. I got to hang out with the good community-minded people at Horicon at the Hello Windows and Doors WTMJ Classic this past week. Wow, what a perfect day for a golf outing on Thursday. A lot of fun had by all, for sure. Today on the show, we are joined by the president of Colectivo Coffee, Scott Isabella. Later in the show, James Burnett will join us. James is a partner in Big League Distributing. Big League is Wisconsin's first black-owned, black-founded, and minority-owned alcohol distribution company. Talking beverages and more, this is The Upswing. Really good conversation coming up about, you know, not only some big news in their business and some of the moves that Colectivo is making nationally, but we'll talk about the state of the coffee industry. It is National Coffee Month, after all. But I wanted to start out with looking at prices of coffee, Scott. You know, it's something, you know, the price index. We do a regular segment on this show called the Upswing Price Index. I stop somewhere. I'm a big Colectivo fan, but I stop everywhere. I'm an equal opportunity drinker. Yep. So I like to see, you know, what prices are. And you look at global prices right now, 48-year high. What's driving this surge, and has it impacted your business on a local and regional level?
Yeah, it certainly has. So if you look at the price components of coffee, there's kind of three things, and the last of which is recent. But you've got the commodity price. You've got, in specialty coffee, what they call the price differential is what you pay over market price for specialty coffee.
Okay.
And then the last thing you have, again, which is something new that we haven't dealt with before, is tariffs, right? And so – well before the tariff conversation started this year, if you go back to the summer of 24, the C market was in the low $2 range.
Okay.
Then you get to – you exit November of the same year and you're past $3. You exit January of 25 and you're past $4. And this is just the C market price. And then you get into February, March, and then obviously this Liberation Day.
Yeah.
And then that's just an adder. And so the coffee market for the last year has been just going up and up.
Yeah.
And then there's a lag because, you know, we're contracting well ahead of where the commodity price is. And so our prices didn't really catch up to us until the beginning of this year.
All right. And it kind of affects everything along the supply chain, right? I mean, you source the beans, you set the pricing for the customers, for your partners. When you look to price the single cup of coffee, I mean, how conscious are you about the customer that's coming in and saying, wow, I expect to pay $2, $3? How do you look at that from a business standpoint?
Yeah. Well, for us, we're really price conscious. Our customers are price conscious. There's still that customer that comes into our shops with exact change for that cup of coffee.
Okay.
Right? And I experience it every time I work the counter.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're sensitive to that. And what you don't want to do is, at least in our case, I don't want to pass on 100% of the costs immediately.
Right.
I don't think that's fair. We're playing the long game, mm-hmm. right? And we're trying to do the right thing for the customer over the long term. And so if you've looked at our coffee prices, we've gone up since the beginning of the year only 10 cents.
Look at that. 16-ounce coffee was $3.05 this
exactly.
morning before tax.
And if you were to go back to December of last year, it would be $2.95.
Right.
A lot of competitors in this market have gone well past that, right? Plus, you know, $3.50+.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, you've got Starbucks, who's got, you know, what, 17, 18,000 shops
right.
in the
they
country.
They got the scale, yeah.
And they're not moving price.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of caught in between these two worlds of specialty coffee taking a lot of price and then obviously the biggest player in the market holding price. And so, you know, you're looking at the consumer, you're looking at the competitive set, and then you're looking at what other levers you have within your business to mitigate the cost increase for the customer.
Yeah. We're talking with Scott Isabella, president of Colectivo Coffee. What are you hearing from the coffee producers in places where you source from, like Brazil and Colombia? What, any like firsthand stories you can share there?
Yeah, I think it's different by geography.
Okay.
And so there's some regions that have had, you know, really bad crops this year. We barely bought any coffee from Honduras this year. Mexico was we've got a co-op relationship 20 plus years, and that was very hard to secure this year. It was like the last maybe couple weeks of that contract, it finally came through. And because there's this supply-demand disruption within each one of these markets that's somewhat connected to price, but it's also just what's happening on the ground with labor and an internal market. So in Brazil right now, there's more consumption happening within Brazil, which means, you know, less for exports. And so we'll see what happens with Brazil. Obviously, this tariff of 55% is looming.
Right.
And we're not going to be receiving coffee from Brazil until, you know, September, October, November. And so that's just a kind of a wait and see approach.
Okay. Well, let's pivot a little bit to the hyper local level. You've, as a company, been expanding into new neighborhoods, relatively new store in Madison, Willie Street, that area, Chicago suburbs, and do some new cafes there. What excites you most about opening cafes in new communities?
Yeah. Well, for me personally, it's how we go about, one, choosing a location, and then two, the process by which we sit down and actually design a cafe is a lot of fun because we've got designers and architects who have been with the company for many, many years, and they know our customer, they know our aesthetic, but we don't have this cookie cutter approach of, you know, think of any kind of chain that you go to. Right. They all kind of look the same. Yeah. Instead, we take the opposite approach as, all right, we're in a setting. What are we going to do with this space to reflect the neighborhood and the building itself? And so if you walk into, I think, a lot of our cafes, they don't look alike.
Right.
And that's exciting for us internally.
But they feel alike.
Yes.
And then, you know, there's an art and a science to that. I mean, when you're choosing new locations, choosing new neighborhoods, what data are you looking at there? Is it competitive data? Is it, ooh, there's a spot in the marketplace? Is there, wow, these four chains are doing really well, we could insert here? How do you find a new location?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One, there's the traditional data of traffic, density, you know, income levels in a certain area. And then whether the neighborhood's on the rise, meaning we think that you can be off of the main street and there's enough density and there's enough pool happening a block off or two blocks off that we think the neighborhood's going to kind of carry. I think that's what happened with Shorewood. Yeah. You talk to the owners when they opened Shorewood and that neighborhood hadn't caught up to that location yet, right?
Yeah.
And then you, you know, 10 years later, you look back and there's all these great shops around, there's restaurants. And so
So if you can be an anchor development, so to speak, you know, again, you play the long game and hope that the density comes. You're not doing drive-throughs, right?
Exactly. So you kind of you eliminate a lot of areas, right? I think the easiest place to expand right now is on the outlots of malls. You see every Chick-fil-A, every Raising Cane's. They've got this huge parking lot that's underutilized because mall traffic is down. And so they're splitting up those lots. They're putting up chain restaurants with drive-thrus and – that real estate isn't available to us because we don't want to play in that area.
Yeah. We're talking with Scott Isabella, president of Colectivo Coffee. When we come back, Colectivo has a new partnership with a big retailer. We'll dive into that. This is The Upswing. You're listening to WTMJ. Welcome back to The Upswing. Colectivo Coffee began in Milwaukee in 1993. Three original founders started a roasting company in the beautiful east side of Milwaukee, one neighborhood-centric cafe on Prospect Avenue. It's still there, still one of my favorites in the area. Yep. It's just a great space, has a really good feel. But the president and CEO of Colectivo joins us in studio. And Scott, I'm sure as you look at the business, yes, you're about Madison, you're about Milwaukee, you're about Chicagoland, but you want to scale it regionally through retail partnerships, and you have a new deal with Target, at least regionally.
Yep.
Talk about that and what it means for the brand's reach.
Yeah, so we We launched in Target in July of 2023. Okay. And, you know, the way that you gain placement in these retailers is, I wish there was some magic formula, but it's really just the disciplined, you know, relentless approach from our sales team led by James Gunja, who, you know, continually contacts the brokers and the retailers to get the brand in front of these partners and really tell the story and, you know, try to show them how we can drive sales through our strong brand, yeah. Right? And so we entered in 2023, but it probably took, you know, every bit of 12 to 18 months of conversation, right? And so we're in the 32 Wisconsin stores in Target.
Okay.
And it's been a great partnership. It was a great rollout. And that was one of the first kind of national retailers that we entered into because historically, and I've been here for 5 years, historically we've focused mostly on the local or regional.
Right. You're in the Sendix. You're in those type of grocery chains where you'd expect to find your local coffee.
And so we always kind of thought that those retailers, meaning the Targets, the Meijers of the world, were somewhat closed off to us. Mm-hmm. But there's been this other wave of energy, which is the consumer wanting specialty coffee.
Right.
And so it's no longer kind of a niche demand. And so when you go to a Meijer or you go to a Target, you almost expect to have those kind of brands in the set.
Yeah.
And so I think we finally dissuaded ourselves from let's be exclusive with kind of local players and let's expand.
Well, and how do you balance that? Because you want the brand's independent nature and local appeal, but you're scaling through a corporate giant. I mean, is there a push pull there, or is it just like, hey, let's get the shelf space and let's sell?
Well, I think a contradiction is created if you abandon your principles within your local retail model.
Okay.
Right. And so, if you said, "Hey, we're scaling with these other retail partners, and some of them are national," and I no longer want to invest in my stores as heavily. When I put up a new store, I'm going to try to cut costs by 30% because construction costs are up. So I'm going to go from this beautiful store that we talked about earlier, and instead I'm going to put 2x4 white tile on the walls, and I'm going to go to some discount furniture store and put those for tables on the patio. Like, we don't do that. And I think as long as we can stay true to those principles, expanding access to people who might not be near a cafe 20, 30, 50 miles, 100 miles away, I think we can do both things.
Yeah. Are there plans on the table for more national partnerships? You said, as we were talking during the break, you're in Seattle as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So we just entered the Seattle market 2-3 months ago with a partner up there called Metropolitan Market, which would be the equivalent of like a Sendix here in Milwaukee.
Okay.
And then, you know, other retailers, you know, national retails that we're in locally, Costco, Meijer, Festival Foods, Fresh Time. So there's a number of retailers that we've gained entrance into in the last, you know, couple of years.
Okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about workplace and culture. I mean, you've had some tough labor headlines in the past couple of years, some union negotiations and, you know, some worker concerns. What are the steps that you've taken as president to foster, you know, that right culture in a healthier workplace?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, myself along with the leader of people at the company, Seth Brody, we negotiated those contracts a few years ago and have a good relationship with the union. And I look to a couple things. One, our retention is at an all-time high, meaning our turnover is at an all-time low, at least since I've been here for 5 years.
Okay.
And so I look at that as an indication, but you also can't just look at that because that could also point to maybe a tighter labor market, right? So the next thing I think you have to do, and I do this for myself, which is you have to philosophically answer the question, what makes somebody satisfied with their job? And there are different answers,
right?
And the answer that I want to focus on is, and I think where most people get fulfillment from their jobs and their careers is, how do I interact with my immediate team? What kind of respect do I get from my immediate team? Because those are the people that you're with 8-10 hours a day,
yeah.
right? And so what we've really focused on is making sure, especially in the cafes, that the cafe managers are set up for success so that they can create that environment, as opposed to in a decentralized model like a cafe model, the cafe manager having to be this superstar who does everything, facilities, you know, the driver for the delivery didn't show up, so now they're getting in their car and they're picking stuff up. Like, you de-stress that environment so they can focus on their employees while you also give support through the people team and through marketing and your other functions. And it avails you to create this, again, environment where people can feel supported and they can interact with their teams in a healthy way.
Yeah. I mean, I think good, healthy companies want to live up to their corporate values, if you will, but also provide the right opportunities for employees to grow.
Right.
And you grow through good culture and leadership and teamwork.
Right.
Let's talk about the menu innovation a little bit and the cafe culture. It's been interesting to kind of watch what Starbucks is saying on a regular basis, right?
Sure.
About the cafe culture and the return. Hey, we want you to hang out in the cafes.
Yeah.
We want you to stay, free refills. Are you seeing that in the cafe space at Colectivo's in Madison and Chicagoland and Milwaukee?
Yeah, I mean, we've always been I think a great example of, you know, come in the cafe and stay. Actually, we have a marketing campaign digitally here in Milwaukee that is called Come Stay. Like, come in the cafe, stay.
All right.
And, you know, 75% of our traffic still comes through the register.
Mm.
And so if you compare that to some of these other, you know, somewhat digital first brands,
right.
I kind of put Sweetgreen in that category, well over 60% of their volume is coming through digital channels.
Yeah.
And ours is closer to, you're,
you know, ordering in advance, you're picking it up, and you're leaving.
So when you see things like, you know, I just left Humboldt, there's constantly people in there playing chess. Recently, there's been a guy outside on the patio playing guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's trying to learn how to play guitar, and, you know, he feels comfortable being outside on our patio.
Yeah.
And I think that's great.
Yeah.
Right? I think this idea that you can come into a space and obviously be respectful of it,
right.
but, you know, use it as a gathering point. I think a great example of it to drive it home further is like around election time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people come in the cafes because, you know, they're chatting, they're having this social.
They want to build community. Right. They want a sense of community. They want to talk to their neighbors.
Right. And they use us as that conduit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't think we've ever abandoned it.
Okay.
I think Starbucks is trying to find it again from when you walk into a store and you got 8 seats to choose from.
Yeah.
And all of them are pushed against the wall.
That's right. Got to make it comfortable too.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Scott Isabella from Colectivo Coffee joins us. I want to do a kind of final, fun, forward-looking lightning round.
Yeah.
You up for that?
Yeah, of course.
All right. What is your favorite Milwaukee coffee other than Colectivo?
Yeah. Ex-Colectivo employee Scott Lucy's got a shop called Likewise downtown. I think he does a great job. Big fan of the Sunset Turmeric. It's a turmeric drink.
Okay.
I'm a huge fan. But
you'll
see me there, you know, 3-4 times a month.
Nice. All right. So what's the best coffee you've ever had then?
Oof. The best coffee
yes.
I've ever had? You know, the best coffee drink I ever had was out in L.A. at a place called Kumquat. And I went 3 days in a row to get a mocha. And I don't know how it was so good, but yeah, the owner was pouring just absolute diamonds off the bar.
All right, I'll put that on my list.
Yeah.
What's the coolest collaboration or event that Colectivo has been a part of in your time? And I really admire about the brand, you've worked with the Symphony, you've worked with other similar organizations and really embraced building community. And I think that's truly important.
Yeah. It's tough to pick one. I think over the last few years, we've done a number of things with local artists that have been really fun for our teams. Actually, just last Saturday, we had a ceramicist who had a studio in Bayview and has done work with us in the past. She, and it's called Little Fire Ceramics, she moved to the Ravenswood neighborhood where we just opened a cafe last year, and she did a pop-up. We did a raffle with some of her work. And so, we're able to talk and, you know, participate with artists in those ways all the time, and they're excited to work with us.
Yeah.
So we've done a number of things like that. You know, if you go into our stores, all of our mugs are made by a company that's right down near Bayview.
Nice.
So they've got a kiln down there. They're making all of our mugs. It's not, you know, coming from overseas or anything. And it's just another one of those touch points that says, you know, we care about everything the customer experiences.
Yeah. All right. And then finally, where do you see Colectivo in 5 years, both as a, you know, as a company, obviously, and a community connector?
Yeah. I mean, we just opened our first cafe in 2024 after kind of a five-year hiatus of opening locations. And so we're flexing that muscle again. We've got a new cafe, as you mentioned earlier, on Willie Street in Madison. Yeah. We've got one coming on Southport Avenue in Chicago.
Okay.
And so I think as we get better at opening cafes, we're going to continue to expand within those core markets. And then we're going to focus on grocery and growing those retailers and be successful and see if there's opportunities in other categories of coffee, right?
Yeah.
Meaning RTD, SKU expansion within packaged coffee.
Yeah. Very good. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
All the best in the future.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks. Welcome back to The Upswing. I'm Jeff Sherman. We got a bit of a beverage episode today, a beverage show. We're going from coffee to liquor. You know, they mix well, pretty well, especially in the great Milwaukee summertime we're in. James Burnett is a partner with Big League Distributing, Wisconsin's first black-founded and a minority-owned alcohol distribution company. James, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to spend it with us.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me, Jeff.
So let's just – I was like kind of to level set. As someone that doesn't know like what a distributor's job is, what's the simplest way to explain what you do from a business standpoint?
Sure, sure. We're a wholesale business. So essentially we are the suppliers to the suppliers.
Okay.
So your retail stores, your hospitality venues, restaurants, taverns, et cetera, they – everything you see that they stock, whether it is beverage or food, they get from a distributor.
Okay. So a little different from a wholesaler or a broker, where you fit in the supply chain.
Sure.
You work directly with restaurants, retailers,
yes,
and other accounts,
yes,
to provide
entertainment
product?
Entertainment venues, absolutely.
Okay. Yep. All right. What's kind of the, I guess, at the heart of why you guys started the business? You know, talk about like the corporate values. I mean, you've spent time in,
sure,
journalism, corporate communications, and, yep, more, but why get into this business?
So I wish I had this, make up a word, fantabulous story for why we chose to get into it.
Yeah.
We actually stumbled into it accidentally.
Okay.
So my primary partner, my founding partner, Larry Heisel Jr. and I, uh-huh, were working on a nonprofit project, and it was sports related. It was,
okay,
a leadership coaching program for student athletes, for high school and middle school students. Hmm. We reached a point in the development of that project that we needed a celebrity endorsement, and okay, I told Larry, this is sports related. Your family is a sports family through and through for decades here,
yes,
in the Milwaukee area.
Yeah.
Between you and your dad, you probably know more people than I do at that level, so who can we get? Larry thought about it, and he decided on his dad's best friendly rival from his days playing in Major League Baseball,
okay,
which is Dusty Baker.
Okay. All right.
So we called Dusty, said we need your endorsement.
It's a good call
to make. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
We need a video from, okay, you endorsing, and he said, fine, I'll do it on one caveat. You guys come to Sacramento, where I live in the off season.
Okay.
I'm not sending it, you know, digitally. You're going to come record it yourselves. And we resisted, pushed back. He insisted. We went to Sacramento, spent 4 days with him dragging us around dive bars and sports bars and showing us the city. And finally, on day five, he told us he had one more place to show us. It turned out it was his tasting room for Baker Family Wines.
Oh, okay.
We were surprised. Hmm. Did you get a winery? Oh, I've had it for a while. And we learned, spent a little time learning about the winery. And he said, I'd love to be able to sell this in the Midwest. Hmm. I have such a history in the Midwest. Before I could stop him, Larry blurts out, we'll do it. We'll sell it. And
so you found a business partner and a product,
right,
at the same time.
Right.
Like, business plan done.
So, yeah, I told Dusty, caveat to what Larry said, let us go back to Milwaukee and do a little research.
Yeah.
And the former journalist in me said, you know, we've got to be methodical about this.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent about a year researching the industry,
okay,
insides, outsides, ups and downs, and finally came to the conclusion we could do this viably. And we called Dusty and said, okay, we've done our homework. We're in.
All right. We're talking with James Burnett from Big League Distribution. So let's just talk through the mechanics of a deal, James. Like,
sure.
What does a typical deal look like? I mean, you have a product in the wine, but sure, you rep other products as well. Like, how do you get them to the shelves, and what does that look like? I mean, you don't have to walk through the entire thing, but like as a consumer, I'm always amazed, like, why is this product on the shelves versus that product?
You know, it's funny. That has been the hardest part of building this business.
Yeah.
I think Larry and I came in with rose-colored glasses, and we thought, perhaps arrogantly, we both are so well-connected, and Dusty is so well-known that even though we're only starting with his product line, I believe 9 of his wines at that time, this is going to be easy. We'll snap our fingers, and every retailer and every restaurant in Wisconsin will say, we'll take it,
right,
and that did not happen. And so we had to build the plane as we were flying it, and we kind of humbled ourselves and reached out to people who have been in the industry for a long time,
okay,
who were not rivals, people
okay,
out of state,
right,
who would not consider us a threat,
yeah,
and said, teach us. And they did. And so what a deal looks like is a lot of shoe leather, a lot of phone calls, a lot of text messages, a lot of trading relationships and connections,
yeah,
asking people who know people who know people if they might introduce us to this restaurant owner they know, this tavern owner they know.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we get their attention, knowing we might only have it for a minute or two, making a hard sell. Like we have Baker Family Wines, award-winning wines. We have these spirits, whiskeys and whiskey bourbons that are amazing, and these non-alcoholic wellness beverages, et cetera. And we go through the spiel, and it's a give and take, an ebb and flow. We have some retailers tell us, I like the sound of this one, not that one. Bring
so
me
you're
sample.
Providing a menu, and they're
absolutely
selecting from the menu in terms of what their needs are.
Absolutely. And so we have a small team in terms of sales, and so we have taken a philosophy of all hands on deck.
Yeah.
Larry and I do a lot of the sales ourselves. We
mm-hmm.
squeeze them in between other projects.
Yeah.
And, take samples of our products to people and say, this is what you asked for, taste it, and
mm-hmm.
how might we convince you?
I mean, you talked about the outreach to other distributors, you know, finding what those learnings are. But what's that distribution landscape look like in Wisconsin? I mean, on the beer side, you have the Badger
sure.
Liquors, you have Beechwood, you have General Beverage,
yep.
you have all these big companies. How do you fit in? Do you... Is there a collaboration there, or is
sure.
it all just a competitive thing?
That is a great question, and I would say it's almost all competitive.
Okay, right,
so
okay,
you have
right.
the extra large distributors that you just referenced,
yeah.
and then there are probably a second tier, and this is not in terms of quality, just
mm-hmm.
size.
Yeah,
a second tier of distributors that are medium large that also do not consider themselves to be direct competitors to the Gin Bevs and
right.
Badger Liquors, et cetera.
Right.
And then there are the really small distributors like us. There are a handful of them. How we distinguish ourselves, and I don't say this to disparage any product,
yeah.
we don't carry anything that you can get anywhere. That
okay.
was our internal motto from the start. We are
okay.
not going to carry anything that you can find.
So you're selective in terms
Absolutely.
Of what you sell.
And so we have crafted ourselves and promoted ourselves and marketed ourselves as a boutique distributorship.
Okay.
So.
All right. What are you finding that retailers and restaurants are looking for today? I mean, there's been some reports that have come out. People are drinking less.
Sure.
Obviously, the move to more healthy,
yeah.
longevity-based beverages almost. Like, are you seeing that in the marketplace, that people are maybe drinking a little less alcohol and more healthier stuff?
We are somewhat, and this may be purely anecdotal,
yeah.
not at all scientific, but our experience, especially over the past, I'm going to say 6 to 9 months or so, has been that our customers and those people who are on the fence have asked for less wine. When it comes to alcohol,
okay.
less wine and more spirits.
Okay.
So we big demand, a lot of inquiries about our whiskeys, our whiskey bourbons.
Okay.
Outside of the realm of alcohol, we're getting a ton of inquiries for our non-alcoholic THC and CBD-infused beverages.
Yeah,
A lot of those, more than we ever anticipated.
Okay.
We just started carrying a product called Moon. It's spelled with 2 X's instead of 2 O's. which was it's a THC-infused wine that tastes like alcohol. You wouldn't know any better if you tasted it and no one told you this is not alcohol. You wouldn't know. The founder is a Homestead High School graduate. Darnell Smith was an All-American high school football player, went on to play at Notre Dame, and he has been in the spirits industry for a long time. Again, Larry and I have connected with people, and our third partner, Chris Mehta, we've connected with people through word of mouth. And people ask all the time, how do you get to all of these unique beverages? We reach out to people. Sometimes we cold call. It's rather than waiting for an invitation or an introduction, we'll reach out and say, this is who we are. Talk to us or not. We connected with Darnell and started carrying his product. And as soon as we told some of our existing account holders about it, they went nuts in a good way.
Yeah.
Like, tell us more, bring us samples. And so we have seen that pattern, decreasing wine requests, increasing spirits requests, and really increasing requests for the CBD and THC and food stuff.
Yeah, that tracks for sure. So when you're at home on a Friday night or you and your wife are going out, what are you drinking, James?
I am drinking, this is shameless self-promotion, Black Eden 1912. It's a bourbon whiskey out of a distillery at just outside of Detroit that we carry. We are the exclusive distributor of the iconic brand, the owner of that brand in Wisconsin. It's the official bourbon whiskey of ESPN. They use it to mix their cocktails at the ESPY Awards every year. It's got a sweet, almost flowery aftertaste. I love the stuff. So that's my pregame drink before the wife and I go out.
All right. Very good. When we come back from the break, you and I share a passion around youth sports and specifically basketball. You have some ideas and I think a new program coming in the AAU world that I want to talk through. This is The Upswing. We're talking with James Burnett from Big League Distributing, and you're listening to WTMJ. Welcome back to The Upswing. I'm Jeff Sherman. We're joined in studio by James Burnett. James and I just had a really good conversation about his alcohol distribution business, Big League Distributing. Another big league thing in your world, though, with youth sports, James. And I think you and I share a lot of passion there. We have a 17-year-old who's been playing basketball forever. Our daughter plays youth sports, basketball, soccer, volleyball. And navigating that youth sports, especially like the club sports landscape, can be pretty tricky for parents and grandparents, right?
Yeah, tricky is diplomatic.
There's a lot of options. Sure. There's a lot of cost. There can be a ton of travel.
Yeah.
And you want to do best by your kids, right? And we all do. And we want to plug in and make sure that, you know, they become the best versions of themselves.
Absolutely.
But what have you found through your club experience? Maybe what do you want to do about it?
Yeah, you know, it's I'm glad you asked. So my son has been a part of AAU basketball for years now. Like you said, I've been a youth coach.
Yeah.
I've coached in school division rec leagues and in AAU. And my experience has been that a lot of these AAU programs these days are run like businesses. AAU, it's a 137-year-old national network of nonprofits. It was never intended to be run as a business. These local chapters were not intended to be run to be profitable. Mm-hmm. They were meant to be nonprofits that assisted talented kids with getting better.
Skill development.
Built people, much like the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts.
Right.
Skill development, but also building character and people.
Yeah.
And what I have found increasingly, and I readily admit I'm cynical about it, is that you have programs that after they fee and nickel and dime families to death to be a part of the club, the kids aren't really developed.
Hmm.
It's about developing the brand of the club or the program.
Yeah.
And that kind of led me to be disenchanted. And a partner coach of mine, he and I have worked together, a great guy named CJ Jessup.
Yeah.
We've coached together side by side for the past several years. And he reached out to me recently and said, we're starting a new club.
Hmm.
Like, I am not. I'm too busy. I said, no, we have to for these reasons because we're so disenchanted with how it's gone. And so we started Apex
Elite. Saw an opportunity
Elite.
In the marketplace, right?
Yeah. And so we created a new program, Apex Elite Basketball Club.
Okay.
This will be our coming into the spring will be our first AAU season. And we're starting off with U15.
Okay.
We will expand as we add coaches to other age groups, but the whole point of Apex Elite is that we want to do a reset on the AAU landscape and sort of prod people to action, remind them this is what AAU was started for. For example, CJ being the co-founder of this program with me, we have pledged we're not taking a dime. Funds that come into our program will go to travel costs for kids and their families. Fees for families will be capped out at the approximate cost of a single tournament, roughly $500. Nothing more.
Yeah.
We're not asking, telling you have to buy this and buy that and get this swag or that swag to be a part of the team or the family. Right. That's not what this is about, and we want to demonstrate that.
Yeah, because there really isn't a playbook for youth sports, right?
Sure.
There's so many options, and I think that's a good thing. Having a lot of options is a great thing. You want maybe there's a rec department program, maybe there's a club program, maybe there's a national travel program.
Sure.
And you got to make the best choices for yourself. But as you lay it out to parents, like what is starting a new club? What is your advice for new parents? Let's say you have a 12-year-old at home that's saying, wow, I want to continue to play basketball.
Sure.
Map that out for me a little bit.
So, you know, my advice to parents, and I say this from both the parenting and the coaching perspective, make sure your kid has that passion, that fire in their belly. You don't ever want to become that helicopter parent who forces your kid to participate and you only learn years later that they did it to please you. So make sure they have the passion for it, which they will demonstrate by committing to working out, to practicing, to playing. And if they don't, maybe they don't have a passion for it. So get that clear first.
Yeah.
Get them into a quality training program. But don't overthink that. Make sure, just make them work out consistently. Again, I hesitate to say make them. Make sure they want to.
Exactly. Right.
Have them work out regularly, practice regularly. I share with parents sometimes an anecdote that I saw Del Curry give in an interview a few years back. About his famous sons, Steph and Seth Curry.
Yeah.
And he said that there came a point when they were in middle school that he pulled them out of AAU basketball. It's like, I did not want them to play organized basketball because they were just caught up in this jumble and they weren't really developing. They were participating, but they weren't developing. So he pulled them out for two consecutive years and just had them do nothing but work out every day with a break or two here or there. Shoot every day, hundreds of shots, and didn't matter how many they made, it was more about getting up those shots and developing their skills. And only later in their teenage years did he bring them back to AAU basketball. And you know,
that's good advice. I mean, I always tell parents also that if you have a kid that's really passionate about sports, make sure you're teaching them how to be a coach as well. Have them coach their peers.
Sure.
And see how they can learn from one another.
Absolutely.
And then also, you don't want to treat it like a business, but you have to be transparent with what those business costs are going to be.
100%.
Knowing the expenses and knowing what travel is going to cost, because it can get expensive really quickly.
And so, it's funny you say that. So CJ and I, one of the things that we had to determine before we launched this program was, were we going to be able to put our money where our mouths were? I'm being a little facetious when I say this, but there's a limit to how much I was going to dig into my own pockets to support a program. I've done that for years. I can't tell you how much I've spent, all joking aside, supporting other families who did not have the funds on our teams, paying their participation fees.
Right.
And so we made quiet outreach to people in the business community around here and said, here's what we're trying to do and why. It's a good thing, and we're trying to build leaders as well as basketball players. And to our pleasant surprise, we had a number of businesses reach back out and say, we will absolutely donate to this program. We're like, fantastic. The costs were a huge consideration, and it took probably a couple of months to work that all out to see, will we be able to sustain this, or are we going to find egg on our faces next year telling parents it's going to cost you more because we don't have enough.
Yeah. So very good. I love the approach. Nothing builds community like sports, so keep doing the good work. Appreciate all you do, and good luck with the new club.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Jeff.
Yeah.